Hello, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're talking about booze.
Yeah, why didn't you say good morning? You're trying to fool everybody.
No, good
morning. Trying to get them to thinking
morning,
it's a different
rabbit.
Program.
Good morning, rabbit.
Yeah, right. I'm just, for whatever reason, we won't let on why we're not having a very good morning this morning. But that's not because of you guys. We're delighted to be with you. It's just that Peter's been hitting some wrong buttons. And we'll try to make sure that this time we don't hit the wrong buttons. And starting off the program today
is 86 Company.
Which is a purveyor of spirits. A bottler and purveyor of spirits with a difference, because their focus is on bartenders, what bartenders need in the booze and the bottles in which the product is delivered.
Well, they explain all that. Why don't we just let them have the chance to explain?
Sure.
Listeners, as you well know, I am not easily intimidated by people's resumes or bios, but in this case, well, not intimidated, but I am certainly humbled. Malte Barnico, you've been everywhere, you've done everything, you speak five languages fluently, and you've always been in the booze business, right?
Yes.
You are by nationality Swedish?
That's right, and thank you for having me on the program, and thanks for those kind words.
Oh, well, it's just amazing. You were raised in Brussels, you lived in Bogota, you have this fascinating company now.
Right.
And it's called The 86 Co.
Yes.
Tell us what it is.
Well, The 86 Company is a group of industry professionals. Three of us are bartenders that have extensive, I would say, careers in the sort of the cocktail industry and running bars in Manhattan. And the idea came from exactly that. They felt that there was a large amount of spirits and products to choose from, but there was nothing really for the professional bartender. And that's where the sort of the idea came from, that we wanted to create a company that could cater directly to the trade, to bartenders.
What do you mean?
So most, if you look at any back bar or any shelf in a liquor store, you'll find a lot of products that are beautiful and of high quality, but the product itself was designed for consumers. So a lot of the times the flavor profile is a little bit watered down because you want to cater to as broad an audience as you possibly can. And also the design of things like the bottle and the label and also the marketing is what bartenders might call fluff. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that because it's one strategy, but for a bartender, the fact that the liquid was inspired by the rolling hills of Ireland is not very interesting. They want to know, you know, they want to know how the liquid was made, what kind of stills were used, and why, and all of these sorts of things.
So if you like, what you're saying is that the producer of a spirit as a consumer good is interested in the appearance of the bottle to someone who's going to buy it in a shop.
Exactly. So what happens when you do that is you design a bottle that's, number one, it's expensive usually because it's using high-end crystal, and it's also awkward. It won't fit, a lot of times it won't fit in the well, and it's difficult to grip if the design is such that some short squat bottles you have to almost grip with two hands in order to pour from it. Things like shrink wraps on the cork, you have to grapple with these sort of awkward closures before you actually manage to open the bottle. And all of these things takes time away from the bartender that he needs to fill the register, quite frankly.
Right. Now, your bottles can't be exactly cheap, though, because
they're
embossed. But the important thing is they're embossed on the surface with measurements.
It actually wasn't expensive to make. You have two choices when making a bottle. Either you make a bespoke design, in which case you have to invest in a mold, which is a bit of an investment, but it's not exorbitant. Or you can go with what's called a stock bottle, which is already existing designs. We went with the former because we felt like we really needed to speak to the bartender and to make their job easier. But we went with a low-grade flint because we didn't need sparkling glass, and we went with a very low-cost closure because we didn't need any cork or anything like that. And actually, the closure that we have is the fastest one to open the market. So we've cut the corners that we didn't need, so to speak, and so we brought the cost down that way.
But the bottle still, it speaks the bartender's language in terms of the quantities that have either A, been poured out of, or B, are left in the bottle, correct?
Yes. It was an interesting process, really, because from a product design perspective, it was fascinating because we started with a bottle that we thought was quite pretty, and then we added all these elements that came from over 160 interviews with cocktail craft bartenders, and we added all these elements, and what happened was that it looked very extreme. But as we iteratively went back and forth with bartenders, we actually came back almost to the place where we had started, except there were some elements added. So it was just this natural progression that led us to a very classic-looking, quite beautiful bottle, actually, even though that wasn't really our intention.
Say so if you look ergonomic. What is that? How is it ergonomic?
The way we designed it is that it's ergonomic in the sense that it's easy to grip. So ergonomic means you want to handle something with as little friction or harm to your physical body, right? So if you're pouring 1 liter, heavy 1 liter bottles, and you're gripping it by the neck, you might get sort of shoulder and arm pain. So what we did is we put a, because you're lifting it up and down and you're playing in words, I guess. I wish I was on television. What we did is we put a grip in the middle of the bottle, which is the balancing point. So you're not twisting, you're not taking that 1 liter, turning it with its entire weight. You're in the middle where there's balance. And you also have an easy grip on the neck as well.
Well, I could tell you that I went through this bottle of vodka and I don't feel any pain.
Well, that's good. But maybe you don't use it as much as bartenders do.
Yeah, she probably would be having no pain if she drank the equivalent amount of Grey Goose as well. we forgot to mention, and you didn't really give credit to the people, I guess, who helped you get launched on this life of crime, because you work for the famous Swedish company, the Absolut Vodka Company.
Yes, correct.
Which in and of itself is extraordinarily innovative. They had those really clever ads of different objects and different animals, creatures that were all made up of vodka.
It was an amazing, amazing, amazing school to start one's career with a company like Absolut. I mean, there isn't a better, I think, university to learn the industry. The thing about Absolut Vodka is they have the same marketing campaign for 25 years running. I mean, that's a world record. Nobody has one campaign for 2.5 decades. And they managed to do that because they spoke to people. And it's something that was new at the time. Now I think, the sort of marketing has evolved and they've learned. But back then it was so groundbreaking that you could actually do advertising for a product without really speaking about it.
Right, yeah.
The imagery. But what people forget, and the reason why a lot of entrepreneurs fail in the spirits industry, is that you don't build a business through advertising. You have to do the sort of the footwork first. You have to go to bars and knock on doors and hand sell before you start doing advertising. And that's sort of where we are at the moment.
Now, you don't distill these, but you have currently 4 different brands, 4 different kinds of booze.
Yes. It's an important distinction, and it's one that we struggled with a little bit because we didn't want to make people think that we were distillers. We didn't want to sort of let ourselves off to be something that we're not. So what the company does is we sort of scour the earth and look for the best distillers in each category, and then from there we brief them and have them develop the liquids that we want. So for rum, for instance, we wanted a rum that was very much like the classic that existed in the 1920s in Cuba, when all these phenomenal cocktails were invented, like the daiquiri and the mojito and the Cuba Libre. Those were all based on a liquid that doesn't really exist anymore.
Oh,
and
really?
So we wanted to go back to those roots, and we found a gentleman that now lives in Panama, Don Pancho Fernandez, about 82 years old. He used to be the minister of rum. He used to actually be in the government in Cuba, in Havana.
Minister of rum, my goodness.
The minister of rum in Fidel Castro's government. And he now lives in Panama and makes rum there. So we had him to make the rum that he himself grew up with in Cuba, and he was delighted.
Now, what was the difference? I mean, can you identify the difference in profile?
So one of the things about rum is that since its beginnings, it's gone towards a more, I would say, a sweeter and more aged profile. Whiskey is a category that a lot of other categories look to because they've been very successful in building quality story. And so the aging and all of these sort of properties have become more prevalent in rum as well. But the original rum was white, or aged very little. It was light, rather, actually. That the white rum is something that Bacardi did later. But the original sort of rum in the Caribbean, and in Cuba in particular, was light in color, and it was also very dry. It wasn't as sweet as the contemporary rum. It almost is like someone said, it begs to be mixed. Uh-huh. It's not easy to sip on a rum like that. It's something that you really want to mix with citrus and fresh ingredients.
Now, that's the first product. Now, you pick that one first. You also make a vodka. And I want to just digress in a slightly different direction in the vodka, because I really don't understand. I understand what Aylesbury duck is, which
sure.
most people on the planet do not. Now, how that relates to vodka...
The reason you don't understand, Peter, is because you're not a bartender. When it came to vodka, all of our products are very serious in the sense that we really wanted to be honest and transparent about stories behind them and how they're made, etc. When it comes to vodka, vodka is a very simple spirit in the sense that it's distilled to death and then you add water. So there's not much there to really, a lot of vodka producers will flatly disagree with me, but the fact remains that there's not much of a story with vodka. It's continuously distilled, and there is a growing sense of almost, skepticism among the bartender community, because vodka is deemed a little bit of the sort of the chicken or the tofu of the liquor cabinet. There's not much flavor there. So we wanted to play with that sentiment. And actually, a lot of cocktail bars today don't even carry vodka, and if they do, they might carry one brand. So it's almost an anti-reaction to the sort of the Absolut and Grey Goose revolution of the 90s and 2000s. And so what we did is we chose the name Aylesbury Duck because if anyone knows anything about poultry, they'll know that the Aylesbury Duck is actually the king of ducks. And this is just one of these facts that nobody knows. And we also found a duck, a picture of an Aylesbury Duck, and it just looked like it had attitude, and it just spoke to us. Also, we wanted to joke around with feathered animals, with Grey Goose and things like that. So it just became, we wanted to show that although we take our product seriously, we don't take ourselves seriously.
Oh,
so.
Your stuff is seriously funny.
We noticed that. See, the funny part about it is, I think you must have included all the tiny little text on the labels so that the bartenders would have something to do if the bar was quiet.
Exactly, and that's the idea. Because a bartender's job is to speak, is not only to pour drinks. If their job was only to pour drinks, you could have machines back there. A bartender's job is to make the customer feel like he's welcome and like he's having a good time. And a large part of that is to speak intelligently about what it is that you're doing and what you're pouring. So we included very, very often upfront and interesting information on the bottles. On Aylesbury Duck, we wanted to stay true to the sentiment. And I always say, and a lot of people will echo this, is the last thing the world needs is another vodka. And so on the bottle, we wrote another vodka. So we're trying to make sense, make fun of that.
You guys with a fun sense of humor. Now, the two other products, you make a...
Tequila.
So we make a tequila and a gin. And I could bore you and your listeners for hours about these products. But starting with the gin, one of my partners, his name is Simon Ford, and he launched Plymouth Gin in the United States and 12 other countries back in the day. He's worked with gin some 15 years, and he's a bit of a superstar in the gin industry, and he's always wanted to have his own gin. He's English, and he refused to have the gin carry his name, but we told him otherwise. Peter, you'll know this. An Englishman won't want to flaunt his own name.
That's true. We're very sure. Now I have a whiskey. I have a Scotch whiskey named after me, of course.
Do you really? Just as reluctantly, I'm sure.
it was very embarrassing growing up, because their advertising campaign for longer than Absolut Vodka has had the same advertising campaign.
Oh, really?
Was don't be vague, ask for Hague. and I did get teased a great deal about that when I was younger.
I'm sure.
So this gin is London style?
Yes, there are two styles of gin, really. Well, three, I guess you would say. There's the London style gin, which became very popular.
I love that one that has a little Booker. Is it Booker? No.
Booker, yeah. It has a little top on top.
Right.
That was funny.
Well, the recipe is a very simple one. What we wanted to do with this gin was to bring juniper back to gin, in a sense. A lot of contemporary gins are, for lack of a better word, almost ashamed of being gin. They try to hide the juniper behind other botanicals, such as cucumber, and try to sweeten down the... and again, nothing wrong with that, but a lot of bartenders are a little bit cynical about that proposition for the same reason. It's because it's geared towards consumers rather than the cocktail trade. So we came up with a very simple recipe that's very basic and works very, very well in as many drinks as possible. And so it's a very English, traditional English gin.
I and the tequila undoubtedly is a very traditional Mexican tequila. And before we close, we must let you go and let you stamp some more berries or whatever it is to make one of your products. Right, I'm sure, and people can
buy. Yes, we have a website. May I spend 22 seconds on tequila?
Absolutely.
Sure.
Thank you. The tequila is a little bit of the holy grail of the bartender. So the tequila was very, very important to us to get right. And we found this small distillery in the highlands of Jalisco, which is where the best tequila is made.
Oh, okay.
They only make tequila in the winter months, which makes for a longer fermentation period, giving you much, much more fruitful flavors. So there you have it. It's a wonderful, wonderful tequila. A little bit stronger, 43% as opposed to 40, just to make it pop in mixed drinks. So we have a website, the86co.com. In terms of distribution, we're now available in California, in Texas, New York, and in Illinois. We're working on Pennsylvania. We should have it actually in about a month's time. We're also available via Fresh Direct as of next week.
Oh, wow, that's
so that's
cool.
That's a big deal for us.
That's
wow,
very
actually.
Big, yeah.
Now, can people actually order for shipment off your website as well?
No. That's illegal. So
that's illegal,
we could,
okay.
But we're not allowed to.
That's illegal? Yeah. Is it really?
Well, yeah, it's a very regulated industry. There are a lot of rules to be bent or broken.
I'm sure there are, and we won't go any further with that.
Yep, I want to know if you were going to keep expanding your brand.
Absolutely. We're not a small boutique craft proposition. We're definitely, we want to bring good drinks to a broader audience. We want to be available to, which is why we're not priced super high. We actually have a relatively low price, a very low price, I would say, considering our quality. And that's because we want to be as in many places as possible. So we're expanding abroad. We're already in Singapore, actually. And
where
we
you
have,
once lived.
Exactly. So we had an article in the New York Times last week come out, and we've been in Forbes a couple of days ago. And so that spurred a lot of, especially abroad, a lot of distributors have contacted us. So we want to expand as soon as we possibly can.
Well, you're off to an amazing start, I think.
Thank you, Anne, for saying that.
The concept is wonderful. The timing is right. The Bartenders Guild is rising.
Correct. It really is a revolution, and I'm glad because now finally people don't need to pay $20 for a good drink. You can get nice, fresh mixed drinks in most places these days.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I'm sure we'll hear from more about you in the future.
You heard it here first.
And we'll be back with another boozy story right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, we're back.
And if
the 86 company's in New York, where would you think our next story would be? Maybe far to the left in Portland, Oregon, where there's been a positive explosion in the number of small craft distilleries as people who had an interest in distilling fine booze found out that, in fact, it was relatively easy to do under the state laws of the state of Oregon.
Don't I get to say my Ogden Nash?
Yes, of course you can say your Ogden
Candy's
Nash.
Candy's dandy, but liquor's quicker.
Yeah,
and what
go.
We should have done to start out this morning was to have a couple of shots of Burnside double barrel bourbon.
Well,
and
still,
then we could have probably got the buttons better.
Well, there's still a chance, I guess, because I thought double barreling had to do with shotguns, but it turns out double barreling has to do with bourbon too, as you'll find out. Now, listeners, catch this. Peter got a turn up front, unusually, in an interview with On the Menu, and that's because the subject is bourbon, and while Anne is okay with bourbon, she's really a Scotch drinker. So I get a chance to talk to Lenny. Lenny's last name, Anne has it on the paper in front of it, which he just dropped on the floor. Welcome to On the Menu, Lenny.
Thank you.
And I want you to tell us about this. I think it's kind of a crazy experiment to make Burnside double barrel bourbon. So tell us the story, starting wherever you like.
Start with that he's in Portland, Oregon. That's
sorry about that.
Okay. So the concept of double barreling is basically taking whiskey out of the barrel where it's been sitting for 4 years or whatever, and then you put it in a different barrel to change the flavor. And then double barreling generally refers to putting it in a new barrel. So you do the initial aging in a brand new barrel, and then you put it in a new barrel the second time. And really what I wanted to do is I wanted to use Oregon oak. We actually a thriving wine industry in Oregon, and because of that, we have coopers in Oregon. So I have a place where I buy barrels from, and we can make barrels out of Oregon oak, and they're very expensive, so I really wanted some way that I could get the flavor out of the Oregon oak and not have to wait 4 years to see what it was going to turn out to be. So I took our bourbon and we take it out of the barrel that's been sitting for 4 years, and then I put it in an Oregon oak barrel that's been heavily charred, and I just put it in there for 60 days.
Yeah, and if we do, if we do the mathematics here, imagine that if Lenny's got a certain amount of whiskey and he's going to age it for 4 years, he's going to need a whole lot more barrels to age it than if he only includes it in a barrel for 60 days. And you said you only have just a handful of barrels of this particular new product.
Right. Yeah, and there's a limited supply of Oregon oak, so it's not like I can't buy 1,000 barrels of it anyway. So I really just wanted to do something kind of limited edition. And honestly, I really had no idea what I was going to get for the flavor. It was a big experiment. I had a $650 barrel, and I had to fill it with 59 gallons of bourbon. I hope it turned out all right. I was checking it every week.
Oh, you just had a little sip every week.
There must have been not a lot left. Aside from the Angel's share, there was Lenny's share.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, what gave you the idea of putting it? You went beyond simply toasting a barrel, and you actually charred the barrel.
Yeah, the charred oak was what I had available.
I see. Okay.
In other words, I had to work with what I had, and in theory, the Oregon oak has a different flavor to it because it's growing in a different climate, and it's colder there, and so I really wanted a way to get a reasonable amount of that flavor out. Quick though, that's why the heavy charred barrel worked out really good. Most double barreling, they use a toasted barrel, and that changes the flavor and makes it smoother. And anyway, a charred barrel and a toasted barrel have very different flavor profiles.
Okay, and one's into the word here.
I wanted two things, actually. First thing is, what prepares you to burst out distilling bourbon in Oregon, in Portland? And what kind of preparation? And did you have a flavor profile in mind when you set out, or did you just let it evolve?
Well, one of the reasons we do this in Portland is Oregon and Portland is very support local, and there's already lots of breweries and lots of wineries, and the city and the state government make it easier for us to get started there. And there's already a number of great distilleries there. As far as flavors go, I always have a flavor in mind when I'm starting to create any. So, and then maybe it's not a specific flavor, but I have flavor concept in mind. Like for our vodka, I wanted something to be very smooth. And anyway, when I start playing with flavors, I always have like it's more like a feeling in mind, the flavor feeling. And then I always work towards that.
Now, did it turn out the way you wanted?
Absolutely. It turned out it turned out better than I could have ever imagined. Our standard bourbon is like a traditional bourbon. It's very fiery. It's very bold. Bourbons in general are very bold. And even in that period of time, it smooths it out and then also adds a nice element of complexity and spiciness with the extra oak. But okay. Not too much oak, so it's not overpowering.
So it's mellowed out,
yeah.
But at the same time, the taste is rounder, wouldn't you say?
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely more complex.
Well, I mean, I loved it, but what do I know?
Yeah, there you go. What do you know?
Well, let me put it to you this way. If I were to give you both of these bourbons side by side, you wouldn't know that the double barrel bourbon is made from the regular bourbon if I didn't tell you.
You wouldn't, okay.
That's how much different it changes the flavor.
And it does that in just 60 days. Now, let's expand beyond just what we're talking about here and about the fact that obviously you make, shall we say, a regular bourbon called...
Yes.
Also called Burnside, because Burnside is a district and a street in Oregon. For those of you who've never been to Portland, it's actually one of the main drags. And it was named after a general, I think, right? A Civil War general and not very successful one?
Yes, that's General Ambrose Burnside.
Well, is that why he has sideburns?
I love history, and actually the term sideburns was originally burn side.
Ah.
That meant that man was famous for his facial hair, and somewhere at the turn of the 20th century, it became sideburns, but for about 60 years, they called chops burn sides.
Now, wasn't he the general who was never quite ready to fight?
He did not do very well, yes.
I think he was a Union general, right? But he never wanted to come to arms, and Lincoln was forever getting mad at him, saying, when are you going to be ready to take on these Southerners? We have a war to fight.
Yeah, he was very slow.
I got the right one, huh?
Yeah, he was the commander at the Battle of Fredericksburg, which did not go well for the Union at all.
Okay, there you go. Well, now let's talk some more about the range of products that you have at East Side Distilling, because this is not a one-off venture. There's been a lot going on, a lot of experience, a lot of experimenting led up to this latest experiment. So fill us in on the rest of the portfolio.
I mean, Oregon, of course, grows wonderful cherries, so it's not too surprising that you have a cherry whiskey called Cherry Bomb. But I've not tasted it, but if I think about it, I think of cough syrup.
Well, the cherry bomb is inspired from the Manhattan, uh-huh. And my favorite drink of the Manhattan is that last drink that has the whiskey and the cherry in it.
Oh.
And again, this is another one of these experiments where I have the Oregon dark sweet cherries are so wonderful. They mix just perfectly with whiskey. So I do a lot of different experiments with a lot of different things, and I'm always surprised. Some things you think are going to be great don't turn out so good, and other flavors really surprise you.
Well, what about ginger rum? Now, that's really odd. I mean, who would ever suppose ginger rum?
Well, I love ginger as a flavor, and most bars you go to don't even carry ginger ale. So I wanted something to have a nice, bold ginger flavor. And there's a number of ginger liqueurs out there, but they have a lot of sugar, and they're at a lower proof. This is a little bolder and spicier, so it's great for mixing.
Now, interestingly enough, there's a traditional drink in England called ginger wine.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, which it's a little bit like elderberry wine, but in fact made with ginger and coming in various different guises, mixed with a variety of other spirits as well to make, if you like, a cocktail. If you just like ginger wine, you can just have ginger wine, and you would have it at the same time of a day as you might have sherry.
Oh, okay. Interesting. I'll have to find some.
Now, vodka is a great favorite of the Oregon distiller generally, and you have your own take on that.
Why? Because what do you think they grow?
Well, they grow all kinds of things you can make vodka from, but yours is actually grown from the traditional product, right? Potatoes.
And if you look at all the new distillers, they typically start off making a vodka or a rum or something like that because it doesn't have to age. We can make it, and in a short period of time we can sell it, so we can actually start making some money because distilling is very, very expensive. So, yeah, ours is made from potato flakes, Oregon and Idaho potato flakes.
Oh, that's great. Now, have you tried one? What is it called? Cold Creek? Cold River. Cold River from
Cold
Maine is also made from potatoes.
Is it Cold Creek?
I've tried a few. I don't think I've tried that one.
I'm pretty sure it's Cold River.
Cold River?
And the last time we were up there, they just launched a gin.
Gin and vodka.
Now, do you make a gin, too?
I'm working on a gin this year, so.
Okay,
great.
Now, did we mention, by the way, your overall operation is called
East Side Distilling. I did.
Because all of these products come under that general company title.
Yeah, we have brands underneath our company name. You can do things one of two ways. You name all your products the same name as your company name, or you don't name any of your products under your company name. So,
right.
But you do
being
something.
An artist, I like to choose the more complicated route.
Yes, of course. Lenny, we might mention that in case somebody doesn't want to drink or if they've had enough that they want to have a photograph taken, you also do that. You're a professional photographer.
Yes, I do. I shoot pictures for a living. That's what I do.
That's why I love Portland. So many interesting people.
But as we said just before we came on the air, listeners, it's really interesting. It's a good job Lenny has another job. Otherwise, he'd be tasting even more of the product during the day. And what it needs to do is it needs to have a chance to mature on its own. Now let's get to either the good news or the bad news. We were very fortunate because a bottle of Burnside double barrel bourbon arrived through the good offices of either FedEx or UPS, I forget which. But in terms of availability across the United States, how do people get some? Is quantity generally available, or is it something where you have a waiting list? What's the deal?
Right now we have it available at our distillery only. I am working on, we do have more batches in the works. We should be doing our second batch fairly soon, within a month. And then I will try to put some of that online so it can be ordered online.
But the other the other products, the cherry balm and the vodka?
Yeah, all the other products, they can be ordered online. They're also in Washington. And then we're slowly working, getting into more states, but that's a slow, expensive proposition, and it takes a little time.
And your website is eastsidedistillingoneword.com?
Correct.
And you actually give tours? And in fact, the whole lineup of Distillery Road, there are, six distilleries? Somebody can just sign up for a general tour there, huh?
Yeah, you can actually make, instead of going on a wine tour, you can go on a spirits tour. You can stop at several different distilleries and check out a lot of different products and see cool stuff.
And you probably meet Lenny when you're there, right? Lenny probably stop shooting as long as he knows you're coming.
Right.
Do you have an idea what you might do next? I mean, in this fertile imagination of yours, what do you have coming?
Like I said, we are working on a gin. I think I might actually do several small batches this year to try and finalize what I want for our recipe, so I might do some small batches. We did a peppermint bark liqueur, which everyone loved, so I think I'm going to take the same chocolate and make a chocolate hazelnut liqueur.
Oh, wow.
It'd be good, especially after with Oregon hazelnuts, right?
Right, exactly. So, and then I've got a few other things in the works, but they're not finalized yet, so just have to be patient.
Well, you sound like you're having such a good time.
I do enjoy the creativity of it. It is pretty cool to have ideas and go, I really like this flavor. Let me figure out how to make it. And it's always more complicated and never quite goes the way I planned, but that's part of the challenge.
Have you thought of doing anything in using grapes? Using the must to make grappa. A grappa-like substance?
I'm probably going to start setting aside start doing some brandy this year and setting it aside to sit for a few years.
Oh, so. Great. Okay. Well,
I know a number of Oregon vintners, so I'll probably start making some eau de vie and having that sit in barrels for brandy. So.
Well, you're somebody that everyone should befriend. I think that would be a very, very good position to be in.
We want you to be on the menu's friend. We're always available to help with tasting. I just want to finish up on a note that I think is really appropriate, because what we have here is an abundance of fertility. And let me explain, because people talk to us about Portland. They said Portland is in Oregon. Oregon is an extraordinarily fertile state, produces just about everything, probably just about everything except sugarcane and bananas. And when you couple that with a fertile imagination like Lenny has, who knows what you might get?
Exactly.
But it's true.
But Burnside Double Barrel Bourbon is a treat at this time of the year, especially where the temperature's hovering around zero with the wind chill. So we thank you for this wonderful substance, which is helping us get through the winter. And Lenny, we look forward to hearing from you again about whatever your latest creation is. Thank you so much for joining us today on the menu.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be heading for London right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and finally, you're going to explain how we go from booze to London.
Well, it's funny. I discovered a new part of the OTM audio archive just a few days ago. I didn't even realize there's an even deeper archive than an archive of all our programs going back to 2004, and that's some interviews that we conducted in 2009 that never made it into the program.
That far back.
Yes, that far back. And it's really funny, because the reason what prompted my attention as recently as I saw information from both of these fine establishments that we visited then and where we interviewed, in the news. And I started looking for the program dates in which they first appeared, and I found that they had never appeared. Yeah. So here they are from the Ultimate Audio Archive. First up, a very fine chef who we encountered years and years and years ago at a property called the Devonshire Arms in my home county of Yorkshire. And then he left there and surfaced again at a restaurant called Latimer in a property called Penny Hill Park, which is near Bagshot, just outside of the city of London. And Michael Wigner not only got a first star there after he moved there, but he got a second star too, and two stars for an English country hotel is pretty good going.
Yeah.
As you listen to how composed this young man is and how well he knows his trade, you won't be at all surprised. And this is a place that's worth a detour.
We have Michael Wignall here, and we've had him before on the menu. Actually, Peter did. I was not part of that wonderful evening that Peter describes. But not here, not in at Penny Hill Park, which is where we are now, at a restaurant called Latimer. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you.
Now, Michael is the head chef here, and he's been head chef in a number of places, and I think we can call him a Michelin star magnet. You just got one here, thanks to you, Michael. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yep, it's a good achievement in such a short space of time. You know, I've only been here a year, but, you know, that's what they got me here for, so hopefully carry on, yeah, and build on that. Yeah.
You're such a pro. It just always amazes me. You just have whatever you're going to do, you go about your business, you get it done, and you make it look easy.
It's not easy, but, no, I enjoy, you know, you've got to enjoy what you're doing in life, I think.
Tell us where we are, or tell me where I am.
West
of London, you said.
Yeah, we're in west of London, in Surrey, about 40 minutes away from London. Sunningdale's close by. We've got Ascot close by. Windsor, you know, old where the Queen lives on the weekend and things like that. So it's quite a wealthy area.
And I noticed that we're having a lot of work done over there.
Yeah, we're just having some renovations done at the moment. Sorry about the noise.
Well, for those who don't know it, I mean, I didn't know even of the existence of this Penny Hill Park, but it is wide-ranging, it's huge. We are immersed in very, very gorgeous countryside, which is, though, not farming so much, you pointed out, as it is horse country.
Yeah, more horse racing than farming, not like Yorkshire, where I've just come from, where it was mainly farming there. So, yeah, sourcing products is a little bit harder than up there, but I'm sure we'll get there.
You said you it takes a while to build your relationships with the farmers.
Yeah, that's right. And any supplier, you know, you've got to get a relationship going, you know, and know your needs, and they obviously know what your demands are as well, and then you just build on that, really.
So, tell us about this menu. It looks exactly like I'd like everything on it. It's very simple. You have starters, then you have sardine, hare, scallop, quail, langoustine, Poussin.
Yeah, I'm a great believer in, you know, keeping your menu simple. Obviously, the explanations are quite simple. I think you can waffle on a bit too much about certain dishes, but, you know, when you have lunch today, I think it'll speak for itself. You know, they are quite complex dishes, but I just like to keep the explanation quite, you know, specific and quite short, really.
Yes, I mean, I hate to have to spend
waffling on for ages about one dish. Yes,
I hate that. Absolutely hate it. Now, you describe your menu as European.
Yeah, modern European. I wouldn't say it's modern English, you know.
What's the difference? I mean,
I don't know. I think it's just, I do use quite a lot of European and Asian influences as well. You know, you're always looking for new things to use and keeping on top of the game, really.
Now, you like to travel, you told us. You've traveled in the Far East, for example?
Yeah, I have, yeah. I love the Far East. I think it's important, especially in my game, sample as many cultures as possible, really, while in any string of life, really. I think it's important to do that.
Tell us about what places have amazed you when you've traveled?
See, the Far East is a lovely place. America as well, great. I think.
But you weren't eating, you said. You just got back and you were skiing.
Oh, no, I was snowboarding. In Colorado, yeah. But I've been to Napa before and all the top restaurants. Obviously, been to the French Laundry and things like that, which is fantastic. Spain as well is a fantastic place at the moment to eat.
Oh, yeah.
Really, really influential.
Were you there recently. We were just there too.
Yeah, last year I went to San Sebastian.
That's what we did.
Yeah,
yes.
And at three stars there, and yeah, it was
Arzak. Did you?
Yeah, I did Arzak. Yeah.
Did you do Mugarit?
No, I didn't. I was booked in there, but it was just too. We did three meals in sort of a day and a half, so it was just too far to drive. We did Martin Berastagio as well, which was probably one of the best meals I've ever had.
We love him. Yeah.
Yeah, really, really good. Yeah, yep. It was.
He's talking, but he doesn't have a microphone. So.
Yeah, and a stunning restaurant as well. And where else do we go as well? Camfabs as well. Just near Bath, just outside Barcelona, but yeah, they're all completely different. But at Berastagio was probably my favourite place.
Did you find restaurant Saint Paul in Saint Paul de Mer?
No, I didn't.
Woman Michelin 3-star Carme Ruscalleda.
Yeah.
Next time you go to Spain, you just have to go there.
Yeah, I will do.
Yeah. Well, you know, how much time do you get to travel? You seem to have covered an awful lot of ground.
I was very lucky when I was young. My parents took me sort of all around the world, really, to Hong Kong and everywhere else for my 21st birthday and Bali for my 18th. So, yeah, I was quite lucky and I've always been quite well travelled, really. Obviously, I don't get as much time now because, you know, I've got a 10-year-old little boy that's in boarding school. So,
oh, really?
You know, yeah, which he's just down here now. So that's... You know, at least he's close to me now. Yeah. But yeah, it's difficult with the trade getting time off. But you know, we're closed for 2 weeks of the year, so then get all the holidays in. Then really.
So what do you do next when you've won all these stars, Michelin stars? You're in a good location. I'm trying to think of what's next.
Yeah, well, I'll hopefully build on it. You know, it's a little bit smaller here than the Devonshire Arms. It's only 48 seats. So when the Dev was just over 70, you know, and I can just concentrate solely on the food here, and you know, hopefully build on what we've got. You know, we've just got best newcomer of the year, we've got four rosettes in the AA and obviously the star, and hopefully, you know, build on it and, you know, look towards building on the other things as well.
Well, I mean, I'm certainly looking forward to this lunch. What do you think we'll be eating?
It's up to you. It's your choice. I mean, we do a set menu with four choices, starters, four mains and four desserts, and that includes canapés, amuse, pre-dessert, intermediate, you know, so it's quite a long menu, even, you know, and it's quite well priced. And then also we do a lunchtime gourmet menu as well, a set gourmet menu that's nine courses, smaller size, nothing taken off the lunch menu, everything completely separate. I think a lot of places, you know, they do a gourmet menu and it's just dishes, elements taken off each dish or smaller versions, which I think, you know, a lot of the times a little bit cheating, really. And
yeah, I read an article where a restaurant reviewer said, don't ever order the tasting menu because it's what the chef wants to get rid of.
No, that's I'm sure it is in some places, but no,
either.
It isn't. It's, you know, it's obviously what the chef wants, thinks his deal to eat altogether, really, and it's showing his expression and the different flavors that are available at the time with the season. So I think it's, you know, it's nice to eat, and also you get to eat things that maybe you wouldn't sort of try. You know, some people don't like snails, but they try them and think, God, you know, what was that? It was fantastic. And you tell them, you know, it's a snail or a frog's leg or a cock's kidney or something like that, and they're always pleasantly surprised. Well, most people are anyway.
Do you have any particular chefs in England that you could look up to in particular?
Yeah, obviously you've got Heston, who's doing fantastic things, but it's, you know, it's a different style of cooking. I don't think everyone can do that style of cooking. Uh-huh. Everyone needs to do their own style. I think that's why England's so exciting at the moment, especially around London. You know, we're moving so, you know, I think London's meant to be the capital, you know, capital of Europe now for eating. It's really moved forward.
I remember when we were writing an article about it 12 years ago, we came across this crazy statistic that probably means nothing, that says London has more Michelin stars than New York.
Yeah.
Which was really surprising. That was when Adam Platt was over here. He found out this little known and perhaps not very relevant fact, but it did give an idea of how rich the dining scene is now.
Yeah, definitely.
In England. The interesting thing about Chef Michael, you have to understand this, listeners, is he's so incredibly grounded and sensible and straightforward, and he also has a better memory than I do, because so if you want to hear what he was like a little less than 3 years ago, the May 14th, 2006 program, which is part of the archive we put online a year and a half ago, is when we last talked to Michael. I talked to him at the Devonshire Arms, where he came here from. Who knows where he's going to turn up next, but he recognized me, I have to admit, with shame, that I didn't recognize him. Now, I want to put another dot on the map, too. Just out of interest, because Pennyhill Park itself is a very wonderful property, but it has a rather special feature, something to do with sports. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's right. It's the training, the sort of main base for the England rugby team. They're here at the moment. I think they're just loading a coach, but at the moment with them, they're all off to Wales for the match against Wales. I think it is tomorrow. On Saturday. I'm not an avid rugby fan, so I can't tell you that much. But I know
that it's a silly game to be perfectly
honest. I know that here. Well, actually, in summer we had this San Diego Chargers, is it something?
Yeah,
because they came over to England and they were based here for a week, so a little bit different build to the rugby guys, a little bit bigger, but and the food they were eating was a little bit different as well. Not exactly what you call healthy sport food, but anyway. Plenty of chicken and pizzas and things, I think. But anyway, I suppose they've got to eat that to be so big, really, haven't they?
How about a website?
Yeah, we've got our website as well.
And its address?
It's if you just Google the Latimer, it'll just put you straight through to it.
Listeners, it's spelled Latimer, is Latimer, and that's what you should go. Well, one more. What do you do if you want one of everything on this menu?
Not go for the tasting because it's completely different to the normal menu. Just come back again or stay for a couple of nights, or if you like certain things on the menu, you can just ask the maitre d' and he'll ask me, and I can just sort your menu out with a little taster of each. You know, it's not a problem at all.
It looks just wonderful. Michael, good to see you and good to talk to you. You have such a schedule. I hear there are two other crews of reporters here.
I've got two journalists in tonight and one last night. So yeah, it's been a busy week.
You deserve all the attention you're getting. Thank you.
Thank you.
And after the break, we'll be back in London town.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
"2009 was the year we stayed at the Goring. And the last night we were staying there in London, we didn't want to go very far to have dinner. So I said, well, sweetheart, I said, I saw this pub on the corner, just like only 100, 200 yards away from our hotel. Why don't we try that? So we called them up and we said, are you any good? And they said, sure we are. Why don't you come right on over? So we did. It's a pub on the first floor. It's a fine dining room, it turned out, we found out, on the second floor, named for a certain Thomas Cubitt. And Thomas Cubitt is a famous architect who designed many of the elegant mansions in the district of London that's close by to where we were, called Belgravia. It turns out that at that time, Sir Thomas Cubitt, where we had dinner, they had a property called the Panopticon in Belgravia, the Panopticon, and they have two other places open.
The Grazing Goat, I love that.
The Grazing Goat, and what's the other? The other is called
the Orange. Yes.
The Orange Room, is it?
No, it's just the Orange.
Okay. Anyway, you'll find it all. If you Google Thomas Cubitt, you'll find them all. And really excellent establishments. And a very nice young man who waited on us but also told us all about Thomas Cubitt back in 2009.
We think we're on to a new trend in London, but we're not sure. So we're going to explore what a gastropub is London-wise. And we're talking to Tobias, whose last name I'm not even going to try. I'm going to allow him to introduce himself with the whole handle, who is the duty manager at a gastropub called Thomas Cubitt in the Belgravia section of London. Toby, go ahead.
Hi, well, obviously I'm Toby McConkie. I think we're trying to define what a gastropub is, and we were talking just beforehand that defining the evolution of the gastropubs probably the best way to define it, don't you think?
I think so, because there used to be pubs, and they were just pubs, and you drank, and you might find a pickled onion or a scotch egg on the bar.
That's true.
But you didn't get any food. And then there was this thing called pub grub that existed for several years, and there was a redefining of beer. But then we sensed that pub grub was sort of declining. The food quality wasn't as good. And Anne says, you know, when she saw curry with every dish on the menu in pub grub at a pub, then obviously things were going in the wrong direction. So what happened? Who defined the gastropub and what makes it different?
I think as as customers taste how it is, they're going to restaurants, and you know the style of restaurants that are out there now are a lot higher than what they used to be, you know, in terms of food and things like that. And with the accessibility of what customers have to such good food and good quality products, now when they're going out to a pub, you know, if they're having something to eat, they want something a little bit more than just your stock standard soup out of a tin and, you know, some sausage and mash that have been bought from a supermarket.
Well, let's dig a little deeper, because when we walked into Thomas Cubitt this evening,
mm-hmm.
I knew we wouldn't be able to record a word, because on the ground floor, it's like a sort of like a pub, but not quite.
Yeah.
But now we're on the first floor, or as in American terms, the second floor, with a white linen dining room.
Yeah.
So which is a gastropub, or is it both?
Okay, so by definition, the gastropub would apply to downstairs. The way we like to word the restaurant is, we're at Thomas Cubitt, we're a gastropub downstairs, and then upstairs we have a brasserie-style dining room serving modern British cuisine. We don't like to say it's silver service or even fine dining, because we try to be a little bit more casual than what that is. We want to be able to relate to our customers, and we don't want it to be stuffy, but at the same time we want to offer good quality products and good wines.
So a gastropub is going to have a high decibel level.
Not necessarily, no.
But this one certainly
this
does.
This one does, yes. We've been a great hit around the area, so.
But your food's way above pub grub.
Definitely.
Even on the ground floor.
Yeah, definitely. The food is way above pub grub. Also, we offer table service, which a lot of gastropubs don't do in London. So it's just bringing an upper step, and people want that.
Now, where we are, is the menu different than downstairs?
Where we are...
On the first floor?
Completely different.
Completely different. Okay.
Yeah.
So now, is this combination unusual?
No, I think it's a
gastropub, except you've redefined that too?
No, we're not redefining it. It has been done, and quite a few places do it. I think if you went back 10 years, it'd be completely different. But now, London, you will find quite a few pubs that are serving, they've got a dining room upstairs and the gastropub downstairs. And, if you want something a little bit more, I don't like to use the word formal, but, you just want something a little bit more than a gastropub, then a lot of them do offer dining rooms with different menus as well.
Okay, so you're in a category that has those two things in combination.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, while I'm passing the microphone over to Anne, who wants to ask some questions, tell us about Thomas Cubitt, because Thomas Cubitt isn't just a name that sort of got made up. Thomas Cubitt is a real person.
Yeah, the Thomas Cubitt, he was known as the Emperor of the Building Trade and one of London's 19th century master builders. He was responsible for building most of Belgravia and Pimlico, including the north and west sides of Eaton Square and the historic east front of Buckingham Palace. Thomas Cubitt was known to, he introduced tea breaks, and he was also the great, great, great grandfather of Camilla Parker Bowles. I'm sure everyone, yeah.
There is quite a few connections,
yeah.
Okay, now, well, we know who this person is. You also are chef-driven, and the chef's back in his home place in New Zealand, but his spirit lives on here, because this is a fabulous menu.
Yeah, it is a fabulous menu. In terms of menu, I think this one is actually our strongest. It's modern British cuisine, so we do have a bit of game on here, keep everyone happy. But it's a rich winter menu. It's something you could sit by, like as we are now, sit by the fire and eat and have a glass of wine, and you couldn't be happier, I don't think.
I mean, let's just run through some of these things that, I mean, they all have names on them, which is like exactly what you need to do, to have a source, an origin identification. So we have Carlingford rock oysters. Where are they from?
They're from up in Ireland. They're probably medium-sized oysters, but they're shucked fresh here. So it doesn't matter if you come in on the weekend or whenever you come in, you're always going to get fresh oysters here. So they're absolutely amazing.
everything sounds amazing. I have no idea what we're going to eat, but anyhow, you've seared Loch Crinan scallops.
Yeah, they're
Scottish, I assume.
They're basically what are they called? They call it hand caught, not hand caught, but hand dived. And so they're quite big scallops, and they've just been seared. They're sitting on a bed of celeriac puree and then a lobster bisque. Just drizzled around the plate. That's a great combination.
Now, I mean, you've got wood pigeon, you've got duck breast, you've got in your mains. That's just appetizers, listeners. You go into your mains, and you've got market fish of the day, which is incredible. What is this herb-crusted Kilravok lamb rump?
So the lamb rump, it's been herb-crusted. It's been cooked.
It's local.
Yes, it is local. All our meats on there we either get from England, Scotland, or Ireland. We try and buy as much produce from the UK as possible. Obviously, we're a British pub, so we try and provide a British menu.
You know, I mean, I think that listeners really have to understand this is not like what they think of as a pub of any sort. It's like, except that it's casual, which everybody loves, and everybody's having a great time downstairs, but the decor is really sophisticated, the food is sophisticated, and there's this whole lot of variety and just sophisticated preparations.
But, again, to return to the ground floor environment, people can come in and just order one dish of excellent food and maybe one or two drinks and then be off and away to wherever they're going.
Definitely. Also,
and that's still within the gastropub definition.
Definitely. You know, then we do things like we, you know, on a Sunday we offer, only on a Sunday because it's a very British traditional thing, we offer the three roasts. So we'll do a roast pork, a roast lamb, and a roast beef. And now they come with all the trimmings. Of course, Yorkshire pudding. The English love their Yorkshire puddings.
Yorkshire, where the pudding goes? It's my home country. Don't scoff.
I love them as well.
The best part about it is you don't have just one place, you now have two.
Yeah, we've got the Thomas Cubitt, and now we've got the Pantechnicon rooms, which is probably a 10-minute stroll from the Thomas Cubitt down in Knightsbridge.
Pantechnicon
rooms.
Sort of like a moving van. I mean,
How
basically, did we get there?
Well, the building on the street is called the Pantechnicon, and obviously with the and it was destroyed in the Great Fires, the Great London Fires. I'm not sure of what date that is, but they decided to name the building after the building, and also the trucks that they used to drive around.
Okay.
The menu down there is what we call modern European, so there's a little bit more of a twist. We have some French dishes on there, also Italian, whereas the Thomas Cubitt is predominantly English.
So would that be gastropub category, or is it sneaking more towards being a restaurant?
I think it's sneaking more towards being a restaurant. You would say downstairs is a brasserie restaurant, whereas upstairs it does take it up another notch. But it is moving up a little bit step higher than what we've got here.
And listeners, both places are in one of the most elegant parts of London to explore.
Yeah.
And I call it Belgravia, maybe at the definition's border, but it's a beautiful section of the city, and Anne and I are going to stroll through it tomorrow between the Goring and Knightsbridge. But Anne has something else you'd like to ask.
I want the world to know you're not going to let me buy anything. I'm just joking. What I'm just going to suggest for the listeners, I was reluctant to come here tonight, and I was, because I didn't know what to expect. And so I want listeners to know this is going to be a great deal of good dining experience and a lot of fun.
Definitely.
And I thank you for taking the time on short notice to talk to us.
Not a problem. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be able to
chat. Last name again for us, and then do the website.
Okay, so my last name was, my name is Tobias McConkie, a very Scottish name. The website is www.thethomascubitt.co.uk.
Two
T's and Cubitt, indeed. And just make sure you put that in front of Thomas Cubitt at the start.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward. I love being here. Thank you.
Not a problem. Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
And no problem. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.